funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm happy to have as my guest, at last, Mary Caponegro. She's the author of a collection, The Complexities of Intimacy. It was published by Coffee House Press. Her other books are Five Doubts, which was published by Marsilio, The Star Cafe, and her first book was published by the legendary Lost Roads Press. I say legendary because you try and find these books. Unless you have a special, you know, connection, you're going to have to look hard. But maybe Abe Books will help. At any rate, The Complexities of Intimacy is in paperback and in print by Mary Caponegro. I've been wanting to talk to Mary. I've been wanting to meet Mary for a very long time because the stories are so extraordinary in their language, their construction, their comedy, their eloquence, their mysteriousness. And I want to tell you that, you know, there are certain things that I love deeply and crazily. They're not things that people necessarily know of when I mention them, and I don't expect people to. But there's a novella by Mandelstam called The Egyptian Stamp that I'm wild about. It's a great anti-gravity work of fantastical imagination. And in The Complexities of Intimacy, there's a novella called The Sun's Burden, and I've read it three or four times. I still can't figure out how it was put together. It amazes me. It delights me. It makes me laugh. I get more amusement out of it every time I read it. And I want to tell you that if you want to find a novella that's just going to make you feel like you're walking in outer space, you go get The Complexities of Intimacy and read the longest piece in it. It's that novella. Now, Mary, I believe everything they say about the amount of time it takes you to write a story. How long did that particular one take?
Oh, well, I guess I have to be honest about that, Michael. So that was 3 years, I think, in the making. And that includes, I believe, the research that went into it, because unfortunately I've become quite enamored of research in the last 10 years of writing. And every time I think I understand what I want to do with a story, another layer sort of erupts from somewhere, and often that involves having to go find out something in order to create that layer. So I think that was 3 years between finding out about American invention and just the history of invention, and then stuff about harp playing and all the other just general things I have to do when I try to make a narrative make sense from my vantage, which of course doesn't necessarily mean it'll make sense from your objective point of view.
Now, when you begin, here we have several things that happen in a Mary Caponegro story. A family is simultaneously loved and loved to distraction to the point where an escape is necessary.
Yes.
This family wants its son to be an inventor, and therefore, loopily, sort of like the family in Kaufman and Hearts, you can't take it with you. They're drilling the boy every day about which inventor's birthday is today, and what invention was invented today. And the subject of invention, it gradually occurs to you, begins to seem like the subject of fiction itself. He's being forced into inventiveness, it seems to me, and that to some extent there's both a dread and ecstasy, because that's what's required of you as a fiction writer. The new must be invented practically on every page, practically in every sentence. So there's this wild flirtation and anxiety about the new, about the imaginative.
That's a marvelous way to look at it, actually. I, of course, the difference being that one hopes that the creation of art, you know, as we think of it, can actually have in it something other than duty, and have the eros of it is not somehow vitiated by this layer of authoritarian oppression that, you know, rides over it, which is the case for the poor slob in the Sun story who has to have, you know, he's pulled between his mother and his father, and even though that doesn't function in a mimetic fashion with the characterization, as my stories seldom do, there, I hope that emotionally there may be something that resonates there when one imagines what it is like to be pulled in different directions and try to create something which has originality, which of course this poor fellow can't really do because he's enslaved in a sense to his desire to please the mother and the oppression from the father.
And yet he's interested in peculiar grafting. He's thinking about a sphinx that has a ram's head. There's a requirement of him once a year on New Year's Day that he come up with his new invention. And there, you know, there are wild things. At one point he invents a fan to turn the pages of his mother's harp on the music stand of his mother's harp. And, you know, because ultimately his mother is so much kinder to him than his father, but also in her passive-aggressive way, requiring many things of him, especially that he not be himself. The rule seems to be here in the way he's tugged that whatever he may want, it will not be approved of by either of them.
Exactly, exactly. The poor fellow's doomed. Yeah, that is the idea.
Now, the family... It's almost as if in order for you to begin to write a story, a situation of intense and ludicrous threat has to be created. In other words, something that bursts you through whatever reticence might hold you back from writing at an extreme. And so in a story also in The Complexities of Intimacy by my guest Mary Caponegro, a woman's mother and the priest are both simultaneously suckling on her, and we kind of gather that in order for this to have happened, a lot of layers of hesitation or repression have to be burst through. How do you do that?
I mean, in the case of the father's blessing, the story to which you refer, I think that that came into my head in a way that was different than often happens with my narratives, and I imagined the plot before I imagined anything else. I mean, the plot such as it is, if my stories can be said to have plots. And that usually is not the way. Usually something comes about through some very abstract idea or an image or, you know, even just some piece of language. But I think the sequence of events made themselves clear to me, and I knew that I wanted to talk about mortality, which is usually of interest to me in my stories, but I had the sense that this priest would be the figure. I guess that did come about later than the general idea for the entire book, which I knew wanted to deal with family, and it wanted to deconstruct domesticity in some way, and I wanted to eventually, I think I'd written the mother's and the daughter's story first, and I suddenly realized there was a whole family here, but from an you know, oblique sense, I suppose, or an abstract sense, because I didn't want them to be related in any blood way, just you know, a more archetypal way, shall we say. And so when I got to the father, I realized that I wanted him to be, you know, symbolically a father, and that seemed a perfect vehicle for repression and all these things that you're speaking of. And this, I think, comes all too easily to me because having had a Catholic background, and even though my work is almost never autobiographical in the sense that a lot of traditional fiction is, having all that stuff built into my consciousness is certainly, I suppose, convenient. And I thought that this father wanted very much, I wanted very much for him to have an obsession with mortality and with salvation, redemption, but that he would be extremely misguided, though I wanted him to be poignantly misguided. I don't know if I succeeded in conveying that, but I guess it's hard to say how those ethereal images make their way into the work. They usually do in my work. I mean, I guess it's populated with them. And in this case, the idea of the priest nursing as a charitable act for the woman who's given birth and has no longer access to the child. I thought that was the most burlesque thing I could come up with that would also be so absurdist as to convey what I wanted to philosophically, if you will. But when I get to some point like that what you talk about bursting through, I guess I know that that feels right, although paradoxically I guess that's often the place in which, let's say, a conventional reader, an average reader, would balk. That's the very place where I think the fiction goes too far for somebody who'd look for more sedate fiction to read. But it's the place where I think I finally arrived, where I want to get sort of to the other side of reality.
I've read that one of my adored writers, John Hawkes, who had been one of your teachers, was the person who asked you to address sexual, erotic, eros in your work. Is that so?
Well, I would put it this way, that Jack, to whom I owe so very much in every way, for my being a writer, I think what he saw that was a preoccupation, and I think he gave me the permission to honor that. I would put it that way, because at the time that I was working with him, I was writing what I think remains my most well-known story. I mean, in a relative sense, of course. I mean, I'd say my most popular story of my fiction is not in any sense popular, but it is the one that people know of if they know of me as a writer. And I had started that just before going to graduate school, so that certainly dates that story, but I was concerned that it might appear pornographic. I had a lot of anxiety about it, and he really saw it as a visionary piece and was incredibly supportive of it, and gave me tremendous confidence and encouraged me to go with it and to let its irreality be everything it needed to be, and not to fear what people might be put off in the surface. And of course, what one wants, as a writer, and myself as a reader, though I could not claim that, again, your average reader would lust for this. I think you want to get to a place, seemingly get to a place that does cause the reader to marvel and have no idea how you got there, and yet have that sense of the inevitable when one lands there. And it's, I guess, those are the places that I feel gratified by.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Mary Caponegro, author most recently of The Complexities of Intimacy, published by Coffee House Press. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Mary Caponegro about The Complexities of Intimacy. Now, I'm the opposite of the reader you're talking about.
Thank goodness for me.
I want a book that's virtually only composed of these kinds of bursts or explosions. And I think the first one I ever found was Alice in Wonderland.
Yes.
And when you think for a moment that, I mean, people love to describe nowadays Lewis Carroll as a pedophile, but in addition or despite or nevertheless, he was a professor of logic and invented his own form of symbolic logic and used the structures of logic in order to create marvels of greater and greater nonsense. In other words, logic does not have to lead to a correct conclusion in order to be logical. It just has to follow the rules of logic. So it's always seemed to me in these stories that we're looking at the ways in which the conventional can be broken in order to liberate energy, whether that's erotic energy or the energy of hilarity or the energy of hysteria sometimes. Nevertheless, you begin, it seems to me, with a philosophical proposition, but by the time you've started playing, the word games and the devices that lead you away from rationality take you to a first plateau, and then something has to happen in order for you to feel safe there. Now, whether that, for a writer who was raised Catholic, involves sticking out the tongue at the authoritarian education system and the wisdom of nuns, whatever it is, something has to occur in which, in an ornery way, the writer says, I don't care what you expect anymore. You can't expect it of me.
Yes, yes, I think that's a wonderful liberation, you know, that I feel I'm so lucky to have, because I'm a fairly timid individual, but on the page, you know, it's always been a comfortable place where, you know, whatever courage I possess is only in that zone, you know, that I can do whatever I want. So it is, it's interesting that you refer to the notion of safety, you know, so I suppose paradoxically, a safe place to be dangerous. You know, one can play.
Well, it seems to me that everyone wants to get up on the stage, you know, strap on an appendage and play the bugle. I mean, you know, there's a certain level at which what's going on in this book is someone taking enormous pornographic liberties with a known and, you know, just asking the world to dare to assault the citadel of the timid person being post-human.
I like that. I like that. I mean, it makes it feel like it might have a purpose, you know, to be involved with all this nonsense then, yeah. I would hope, I certainly feel that the subversive is essential, you know, in our culture, especially now. I mean, increasingly so. And you know, I guess that's the one way in which it feels like community service, you might say, to be, you know, to be writing in that particular direction, you know, no matter how few people might follow one in that direction. It's something that seems to have that be an option is an important thing. And of course, I'm beholden to, you know, those that came before me and those that stand alongside me doing similar things in literature. And it's, you know, I can't imagine what it would have been like to feel like one had to be the first to break the taboo. You know, it was very easy for me to do so because I have you know, such a marvelous family in that sense of those who allow me to say, look at the institution of family and do what I'm doing with it and you know, poke around at it, but I hope, as I say, also with poignancy and not just in a way that means to be coldly satiric and unmerciful or, you know, not have sadness in it.
Now, do you have any recipes or maps for how to get to that place?
Well, recipes I lack entirely. I'm a lousy cook, and I can't even follow any formula. I feel like it's so interesting you bring up Lewis Carroll and logic, because I think I'm in awe of the logical and the rational and all of that. I wish I had more of a natural ability with, and because I utterly lack it, I think in some kind of obsessive compulsive way, I find myself trying to invent my own, meta system or something like this, and I find myself composing things in an incredibly strange way that is very hard to describe. It's certainly not anything anyone would want to emulate, as I always tell my students, because it's extremely complex.
But give an example. I'm very interested in this, please.
That very first story, one of the literally the first stories that I ever wrote, The Star Cafe, that idea that spawned that, for example, was something quite abstract, thinking about how the afterlife, which is sort of a concern in the work, whether or not it's evident, trying to somehow delineate that in some bizarre fashion. And I was reading Rudolf Steiner at the time, in my 20s, and I was thinking about this concept of an afterlife that was not a Judeo-Christian heaven or hell situation, but some experience where one's behavior would be thrust back upon one. So if somebody, say, mistreated somebody else, they would experience what that had been like. And I had this idea that I wanted to a man who would turn into a woman to experience what it had been like to be in some way mistreated, and then having experienced the epiphany of the redemption, would then turn back into a man. So the conceit was this. Well, there was I put that together with some actual place that I had been living near, that it was a bar, and that used the decor of that place, and there was a sound of a blender in that place, and so I borrowed those actual things and let them go into the dreamscape, if you will, and had this for me, I always understood that what I was driving at with all those incredibly familiar images of the mirrored room and all these things that are familiar, I suppose, from the world of porn, but to try to use that stuff to get to this other place and have the man have a woman's experience and have that be sensually available to a reader through all this irreal world of uncertainty, and yet the whole thing was meant to be at the same time, speaking of Eros, a retelling of the Eros and Psyche myth, because she, being Psyche, trying to redeem herself, having made the transgression of looking at
the face of Eros,
That, but that's not exactly a map, is it?
Suddenly information on a calendar, and then a brother and sister joking about John Deere's tractor, and the feeling that somewhere there's a piece of paper in which arrows and erasures and, all been preceded and worked out, and the fiction is a report on this dream puzzle calendar. And now it's being presented as hilarious, but as if any house you might drop in on this community might have similar events going on in it. That hasn't been confected for this story alone, but it's the way of the world now, isn't it? That's what makes for so much of the kind of joyous insanity in these things. And that also, it seems to me, part of the pleasure is that the via negativa is the way to heaven. That you get to heaven through debasement and transformation.
Yes.
And that debasement is the initiation of transformation in some way.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm fascinated in, with transformation, and all I ever want to do in every story I've ever written, I think, is to achieve that or to enact that. And to me, that's the beauty of fiction, when it can do something more than simply be a mirror to the world, but, you know, create more the, you know, a funhouse mirror or a mise en abîme where the, everything is, you know, the mirror within the mirror within the mirror. I mean, that's the thing that, that excites me to try to do, but one almost has to be obsessive in order to achieve that result, which is perhaps why, you know, obsessive characters come quite naturally. And in that, again, the Sun story, the you know, the obsessive nature of the education that these children are subjected to, you know, allowed me to just pile on and pile on all the, you know, all that research. The fear always is that the narrative then reeks of research, you know, which is a great fear that I have when I rely upon it in that way, because it's exciting to me, but, you know, one can lose perspective on how much to load into the work. And I tend to want to really load, you know, because I go for the Baroque and in all the work, you know, in the Five Doubts book with all the Italian art history and with the, you know, with the complexities, and especially in that, you know, Tristram Shandy-esque, I don't know, route with just, you know, going over the top, because I'm always interested in going over the top, hopefully not just for its own sake, but as you say, to create some parallel universe in which people might believe that everything taken to an extreme becomes, you know, the extraordinary becomes what could stand in for the ordinary, and that's what I'm after, surely.
I've been speaking with Mary Caponegro about her most recent book, The Complexities of Intimacy. I want to say that virtually every time I ask a favorite writer, William Gass, well, many, for a writer I may not have read, they'll always begin by saying, well, have you read Mary Caponegro? And I say, well, now I have. She's really a remarkable writer. She writes very, very, very slowly. So over this career, there are really 3.5 books, and a fourth one apparently on the way. Thank you very, very much for joining me.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, Michael. Thank you so much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books,
books, books, books, books, books, books can be funny too.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books,
books, books, books, books, books, books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.